Hey, welcome to the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. My name is Keyvan Navani. Together with some of my favorite Bitcoin podcasters, Daniel Prince of Once Bitten and John Vallis of Rapid Bitcoin Fire, we thought, you know, we might give it a try and get out a little bit of the echo chamber and have a challenging discussion with Lawrence H. White, professor of economics at George Mason University and senior fellow at the Cato Institute. And because, you know, since I listened to an interview or talk with Lawrence H. White on Nick Carter's podcast show, I had the impression, you know, that Lawrence H. White is a reasonable, open-minded, critically questioning and reflective person. So without further ado, yeah, let us dive into this discussion. We're going to talk about, you know, fundamental questions. What is money? What is good money? What is hard money? What are the fundamental monetary properties of gold and Bitcoin? What are the weaknesses? Is gold free market money, or is it actually Bitcoin because it needs no permission, because it's permissionless, decentralized, absolute scarce, non-controllable? That's, I think, the fundamental point. And this is, you know, the one of the unique, you know, desires and intentions of all of us Bitcoiners. We want to get rid of, you know, we want to eliminate the control over money once for all, in order to evolve, you know, into a higher human civilization on the hardest and scarcest money ever created in human history, and that is Bitcoin. So yeah, so really looking forward to that video. This podcast is roundtable edition with John Vallis, Daniel Prince, featuring Lawrence H. White. Let me know your questions, your comments afterwards, and thanks so much for support and for listening. Okay, welcome to the show, Lawrence White.
Thank you.
My name is Keyvan Navani. We've got here John Vallis, Daniel Prince, all podcasters. So Lawrence, maybe I can start off. I mean, I was really impressed with the talk you gave, or the interview you gave to Nick Carter. And because you made the impression of me, you know, you're like not only open-minded, but you are, as a professor of the George Mason University, if I'm correct. And
correct.
Senior yeah. Fellow of Cato Institute. Maybe it would be wise, what do you guys think that, you know, Lawrence, could you get like a brief background, like what's your expertise, what's your special focus? Because on your Twitter handle it says you somehow study the private currencies.
Since before they were cool. Yeah, back in the... Well, back in the 1980s, I was inspired by Hayek's monograph on denationalization of money. And I wrote my dissertation on the free banking system in Scotland and the debate in Great Britain, in London, whether to have a free banking system in England, whether to eliminate the monopoly privileges of the Bank of England, which was a movement for a time, but the Bank of England managed to quash it. But since then, I've been interested in private alternatives to central banking and schemes like E-Gold and Liberty Reserve and the Liberty Dollar, so-called, which was a silver-based currency. And since Bitcoin came along, or since one of my students told me about it, I've been trying to stay informed. It's a learning process. It turned out I discovered I had written something predicting that Bitcoin couldn't really exist before it was launched. So I've learned from that not to think that we have all the answers. But I'm interested in Bitcoin. I'm interested in I know it's a shameful thing to say, but I'm interested in the other altcoins. to see if they have anything to add. But yeah, that's my perspective. So I'm living and learning, and you know, may a thousand flowers bloom is my attitude. I have certain expectations about what the market will and won't support, but I'm willing to be shown wrong on that.
Would you say is the overall intention, like, of yourself or the work you do in the context of the Cato Institute, the George Mason University, is like, can we like agree, like, what is the overall intention? To create a free market, or what's your overall like vision? What's the purpose?
Yeah, that would be my purpose. So I'm affiliated at Cato with the Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives. And as the name suggests, it's to provide a forum to discuss alternatives to the status quo. So that includes the gold standard, that includes dollarization, currency boards, certainly also includes cryptocurrencies. And I guess our main policy concern is that other options not be foreclosed by decree or by diktat, that the market is the place to trial new monetary systems, not, they shouldn't be foreclosed. Within the status quo, we try to think about what's the least bad thing that central banks can do, given that we've got them. But
would you say that, because there's an sort of a intellectual, or I don't know, some kind of discourse going on back and forth with a bunch of Bitcoiners who also wrote some articles or discussions going on, do we need to wait for the free market, or could you say that, could we say that Bitcoin is the free market?
Bitcoin's an initiative in the free market. I don't see any government supporting it or subsidizing it. So yeah, I would say it's a free market project. It wasn't even a for-profit project when it started. Now it's surrounded by all kinds of supporting firms, but the core of it is social innovation, I guess. That's, we have to see how widely it will catch on. But yeah, there's a market in which it's competing with alternatives.
I think, Lawrence, if you're okay with this, before we kind of get into the meat of the discussion, I'd be interested in hearing, because it's what you teach and have studied for a long time, especially in the landscape that we're in today, which is extremely unique, for lack of a better term, what do you think is the solution to the approach to a monetary standard or monetary policy in the context of what we're dealing with today? What do you and the people that kind of take the same view as you advocate in terms of, better money, a better money system?
I'm actually writing a book with the working title Better Money. so I should plug that here. And
it's about Bitcoin?
The subtitle is Gold, Fiat, or Bitcoin.
Oh, nice.
Got it all. Okay.
Very good.
Yeah, so that's the horse race. But so I have argued that there's good reason to think that in the context in which silver and gold standards were the best commodities to serve as monetary standards. But we're in a different day and age now. Gold and silver have been demonetized. And so it's a tough question. How do we get back to letting the market choose among monetary standards, given that governments dominate the space now? And so the minimum is for them to get out of the way of allowing other standards to emerge privately. But I think there are very strong network economies where people want to use the same monetary standard that their trading partners use. And that means there's got to be a question about whether we want to continue the fiat dollar or fade it out in favor of something more reliable. We're not at a stage where there's any kind of consensus on doing that, though.
Lawrence, Hi, this is Daniel speaking now. Hi, Lawrence. Thank you for doing this and facing three podcasters. We're not here. This isn't a lynch job. This is, you know, to open a discussion. We all listened, I think, to your interview with Nick Carter on his podcast. And there was one thing there that really stuck with me. And it's when you gave an example about people in their home countries, when they start adopting a different currency in favor of their own currency. Now, I've seen this firsthand, and I remember in the late 90s visiting Bali in Indonesia. And if you go to a bar, if you go to a restaurant, even the hotels were asking for US dollars. Even the guy that took you out on a guide to the waterfall, he wanted US dollars because he knows that's how he's going to get to feed his family in the next week or two. Now, this might be a bit of a reach, but I want to throw it out there. And I can't talk for every podcaster. Maybe these guys can weigh in on this. But, you know, my listenership, when I look at this, 45% of my listenership is the United States. And I've heard similar figures from other people. Now, is that a signal to you that perhaps the United States are now turning towards a different currency and are going to start favoring something such as Bitcoin other than the US dollar?
Well, it sounds like your listenership is distributed about the same way the US dollar is around the world. About 45% of it's in the US, and about 65% of the dollars are outside the US. I think dollarization, what's sometimes called dollarization, which is what you're describing, from the bottom up, is an important phenomenon. And too much of the academic discussion of dollarization has been from the point of view of the bank, is it a good thing? Well, no, not a good thing from the point of view of the local central bank, but from the point of view of people who want reliable money, it's a good thing. And by studying these kind of episodes, we can see that people do vote with their own pocketbooks for a better money. What's kind of surprising is how high a local inflation rate it takes before dollarization starts to take off. But in the U.S., there's a lot less of a concrete reason to be concerned about switching to another currency because the dollar is not hyperinflating, right? Inflation's been pretty low. And it seems to take at least double-digit inflation before people seriously start looking for a better money. So in a way, I hope that there's never a crisis of the fiat dollar, that it continues to be reliable, but we should be prepared for the day when that is no longer true.
I'd like to go back for a second to something, Lawrence, you said just before Daniel's question there, and it kind of centers around how this all came together in the tweet that I originally put out. And yeah, I think a lot of Bitcoiners would rebut the arguments by, you know, the free banking proponents or the gold proponents to say that those have been tried in the past, and for a period of time they had been, you know, a relatively stable means of facilitating free market exchange. However, they were always right, susceptible to being stopped ultimately by state intervention. And I think what Bitcoiners would probably suggest is, why would we think that a return to any one of those standards or, you know, monetary systems would net a different result in the future? And in fact, the reason what makes a good money is not that it functions well when it's permitted, but that it doesn't require permission to function. And just the last point on that would be that, you know, thinking of this in terms of, you know, we all want free markets. I think that's a given for at least everyone on this call and a lot of people probably listening, because free markets are a manifestation of our individual freedom. And I think, you know, we all generally want that. But it's, sure. I think what the argument that I would make is that it's not the free market that permits the money. It's the money that permits the free market. And in that context, Bitcoin seems to my mind to be the only one that truly permits a free market to exist, whereas previous manifestations of a monetary system or standards have always relied on the permission of the powers that be to allow the free market to persist. But if they wanted to intervene, they always could. So Bitcoin seems to be the first manifestation of a type of money that is resistant to that oppression or shutdown. And that's, I think, why there's so much enthusiasm around it, because it may very well be our first, you know, first example of a true free market being enabled long term.
Yeah, no, this is an interesting question, and this is what you and I were talking about on Twitter. So it's a problem that a gold standard and a banking system on top of a gold standard is out in the open, where if the government wants to quash it and there's not sufficient ideological support to stop the government from quashing it, it's susceptible to being quashed. And historically, when a crisis came along and the government said, well, now we need to switch to something else, the public went along with it. So that's a problem. But I think censorship is also a problem with Bitcoin if it wants to come out in the open and be above ground. And if you have governments that want to post prices in Bitcoin and the government says that's illegal, then you have a problem. It's not the fault of Bitcoin, it's the fault of the government, of course, but I think there's a, it's a matter of degree how much exposure there is. Peer-to-peer exchange, while keeping it all hidden and cloaked, but it's hard to get mass adoption that way. It takes a certain amount of technological savvy to operate that way. Whereas most people are more comfortable with, you know, making payments using their cell phone or some kind of swipe card. So, yeah, I don't think a gold standard would last if we went back to it tomorrow, which is the point you were making. It's going to take a public understanding of the issues and readiness to stop governments from interfering with it than we currently have. So I see it as a educational mission. But it's important to keep the theory and the history alive so that it's on the shelf when we need it. And I certainly have no objection to people putting themselves on the Bitcoin standard or putting themselves on the gold standard, or in the case of dollarization, putting themselves on the dollar standard if it's better than their local currency.
Lawrence, can
so,
ask?
I mean, I do see that censorship resistance as a virtue of Bitcoin. I guess what I would question is whether that's sufficient to make it a widely adopted money.
Okay, Ivan, did you have something to say?
Yeah, is the core of Bitcoin, you think, Lawrence? I mean, you know, in order not to, you know, make the same mistakes or not to, I mean, it's about the control over the money. I mean, this is, I think Bitcoin was born, as it's called, Immaculate Conception, to be the free market money and to be, just going to call it black market money. But with exponential increase in liquidity, network effects, critical adoption rate, or you might have heard today, even whether it's top down or bottom up or whatever, Paul Tudor today, which we were just talking before you came online, he compared Bitcoin now to gold in the 70s, as for now, you know, as a hedge against the monetary inflation that we are about to face. Do you think it's like a precipice money? Like it's never been done before. So what are we trying to achieve here? We're trying to achieve making the control of money obsolete for once and for all.
Well, I mean, that's a good goal. And I think under historical free banking systems on centralized gold standards, where there wasn't a central bank, where there wasn't central control over any one stock of gold reserves, it was a system that was decentralized and not under any one party's control. But it does involve having vaults, and if banks want to do business above ground, then they are able, and they can be forced, if it comes to that, to turn over their gold, which is what historically happened. But you're right, I think you're right, that today most people who hold Bitcoin are not holding it to use as a medium of exchange. They're holding it as a store of value. And it's another question whether that could be the basis for launching an alternative payment system in a, you know, a large way, in a mass adoption way.
Guys, I think I'm getting some bad sound. If we turn our videos off, it might improve. I don't know if you guys are suffering that as well.
Yeah, I am. I'll turn my video off.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do that. And sorry, John, I interrupted you there. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to kind of, I guess, add on Kayvon's point that I think this is one of the fundamental reasons why people are interested in Bitcoin, because it does take either the control of the money or the power to issue currency away from the state. And, one of the prime ideas is not that it's necessarily completely unconfiscatable or completely censorship resistant. It just changes the dynamic of the attack surface such that it's far more defensible. And this makes it far more resilient to intervention by those who might seek to disrupt it. But to the other point you were making, Lawrence, about, you know, people are holding it as a store of value and not a medium of exchange right now. To that, I would say, generally, I agree. I mean, obviously, the community, there are projects and people are trying to foster, the spending of it kind of in very novel ways. But I would say right now, you're right. But I would also say that that's quite logical and rational. If we are indeed seeing the monetization of a new form of money, as we've seen, you know, a number of times throughout history, and of course, none of us were back then, back there, and perhaps writing didn't even exist when those events happened, so we don't have much context on them. But I would think that if it became obvious that an upgraded form of money were available, and it was in the process of becoming adopted by a broad enough base to eventually use as a currency, then I can imagine that rational thinking actors would look and say, well, this is a better form of money, but it's not evenly or broadly distributed yet. That means there's going to be additional, you know, substantial additional demand coming online over the next X amount of time. So it behooves me to store my wealth in it right now. And, you know, kind of a Gresham's Law dynamic where I'm using the lesser of the monies available until such time that it becomes broadly distributed, the volatility evens out, and it, over a process of time, of course, it doesn't all happen at once, but it slowly becomes used as currency more and more and more until it's the dominant currency.
Well, I think there's something to that scenario. I wouldn't call it a Gresham's Law dynamic, because Gresham's Law operates where there's a legally imposed exchange rate between two currencies. But it does operate, or it could, in the optimistic scenario, operate something like spontaneous dollarization, where at first people just keep their savings in dollars when the peso begins to misbehave. And then they begin to follow the exchange rate day by day. And so they begin to post prices in dollars. And then they begin to accept payment in dollars. They don't go out and buy dollars whenever they want them. They actually will sell goods for dollars and accumulate them. And once everybody's familiar with the value of the dollar, then they can begin to, you know, use it as a medium of exchange. That's actually the last step in spontaneous dollarization.
Right.
But the thing about Bitcoin that we haven't discussed yet, which concerns me, as a barrier to its use as a medium of exchange is the volatility of its relative price or its purchasing power. Now, if you're used to prices in pesos, the dollar to peso exchange rate bounces around a lot. You might think the dollar is too volatile. But once you realize that the volatility is almost all in one direction, that is, the peso is dropping against the dollar, then it's okay to keep your money in dollars, even though some of your transactions are still in pesos. But there's a different sort of stability of purchasing power of the dollar against goods and services than there is in the case of Bitcoin. And unlike the gold standard and unlike dollars, the supply curve for Bitcoin is perfectly vertical. There's nothing in the program that releases more Bitcoins when the purchasing power goes up. Unlike a gold standard, where a high purchasing power of gold will prompt gold miners to dig a little deeper, and that'll help stabilize the purchasing power of gold. And so we see the relative price of Bitcoin has much more volatility than the dollar to euro exchange rate, or even the dollar to gold exchange rate. Something like 7 to 10 times more volatile. And so that's an obstacle to people wanting to hold it as a way of keeping their rent money.
I agree. And I think it's one of the biggest shames of Bitcoin at the moment, because it's the more risk tolerant that are more likely to buy and use the turn of phrase hodl. Whereas really, you know, I think I speak for Kayvan and John here. We would love to see the third world countries having a much bigger appetite to buy and hold this asset, because this is truly what we believe is going to lift many, many people out of poverty. But with, you know, to your point, Lawrence, like this volatility is just too wild at the moment. And I just wonder what's the inflection point? What's the price point that we cross where that volatility starts flattening out a little bit, and those with, less risk tolerance start entering the market? And that's obviously what's really going to, you know, drive hyper-Bitcoinization. It's just a shame it's going to be at much higher prices. Do you have any thoughts around that?
Well, I don't know how a higher price reduces the volatility. So I'm not quite following your argument, I guess.
A larger market cap. So if there was a Bitcoin market cap of $50 trillion versus $150 billion, then it takes up a larger share of, let's say, global money. And also that would indicate that its distribution is likely more widespread. So I would think that would diminish volatility. If we assume that people are adopting it because it's a better form of money, looking toward it becoming money in the future. And so, while I have the floor, I'll just say this on Daniel's point. I mean, I agree, in an ideal world, sure, it'd be great if, you know, people who needed quote unquote better money the most were the ones that were able to access it. But, you know, that's not the world we have. And I think volatility, even though it is generally in the upward trajectory or direction, I think it's unavoidable. If people are genuinely looking at this thing as an upgraded form of money, the hardest money that there ever has been, then there's going to be a lot of demand for that. And along with, you know, those waves of demand will come the speculators, will come the people that try to game the market, et cetera. But I think the reason why we're seeing the price generally trend upward is because every time this happens, more and more people are buying it with the view that it will one day become money. And as a result, they're holding it. And I think on the price stability issue, I think, you know, my view is that is a perspective that's come out of us always having supply elasticity with every form of money we've ever used. And we've never had to consider or contemplate supply inelasticity with money. But, you know, I think prices reflect the ever-changing preferences between millions of people and billions of transactions at any given moment. And price stability will be an emergent property once the adoption of a given form of money is widespread. And any manipulation to its supply to stabilize prices will simply distort the natural market mechanism that it that is using the money as a means to establish exchange ratios or relative value between millions of goods and services. So, like I said in our Twitter exchange, Lawrence, I think rather than being detrimental that supply can't adjust, I actually think ultimately it will be seen as kind of the holy grail of money, but the process of getting there will be volatile. And I don't see any way around that. And you know, that's obviously part of the time we're in now, but I think with greater adoption and with a greater share of global money in the form of market cap, Bitcoin's market cap, I think ultimately volatility will stabilize. And let's just think of a scenario in which Bitcoin is the dominant global currency, then I think the increase, you know, Bitcoin's, let's say it's deflationary, I think the increase in purchasing power on an annual basis will probably roughly reflect, you know, growth, GDP growth or productivity growth in the run of a year as more money is required to transact in the added amount of goods and services in an economy.
Yeah, so it's interesting you use the term hard money, hardest money. I mean, there are two aspects to that. One is nobody can manipulate the supply, and the other is that the supply is fixed. To contrast Bitcoin to the gold standard, when it was an automatic gold standard and not under the manipulation of central banks, you had the first part, you had a money supply that nobody could manipulate, but it wasn't a vertical supply curve. The supply wasn't fixed. When the purchasing power was high because of, say, rapid growth in the real economy, increasing the demand for transactions purposes, as you were just saying, more gold would be mined by this decentralized competitive gold mining industry. So there was a response, but it was an automatic market response. It wasn't centrally orchestrated. And I see from the point of view of money users an advantage to having this force that dampens volatility in the purchasing power in response to supply and demand shocks. It's true that by having a fixed supply curve, Bitcoin does avoid supply shocks. And the classical gold standard did have supply shocks. There was the discovery of gold in California, for example. What people don't often appreciate is how small those supply shocks were, because the ratio of gold flows to gold stocks is very small under a gold standard. And so even though the California discovery probably doubled the rate at which gold was being extracted, that meant it went from something like 2.5% a year to 5% a year. And then it petered out as the gold mines became depleted. So it didn't have that much impact. It caused maybe 1 to 1.5% inflation for about 15 years. So pretty trivial by modern fiat money standards. But with that disadvantage of a gold standard, that there can be supply shocks, comes the advantage that you do get an endogeneity. You get more gold being produced when it serves to stabilize the purchasing power of the gold unit, which seems to me advantageous to most money users would like that. So I can see that you're looking forward to a future in which there's no longer speculative holding, but just transactions holding of Bitcoin. And then the only variations in demand we have to worry about are variations in transactions demand, which there's no reason to think is very volatile.
Interesting.
Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah. Well, I think my disagreement, and it would be a hard one for either of us to prove, is the benefit of stabilizing purchasing power. You know, because, you know, what that having a stable purchasing power, why is that preferable to having an increasing purchasing power? So if you're dealing in a deflationary currency, then over time it's increasing in its purchasing power. So why would people prefer a stabilized purchasing power than increasing?
Well, if it had the same volatility day by day, and the average was zero appreciation for one currency and 2% a year appreciation, that is falling price second currency, then I agree with you, the second currency dominates. But the thing about Bitcoin is not only that it has been a pretty good investment, if you're willing to hold it for long periods of time, but that it's a very dangerous investment if you're looking to get rid of it by the end of the week in order to pay your rent.
Well, I have no disagreement with you there. I'm looking at it not in the context of a short-term investment, but in a, you know, long-term future of money context. What is our best option for a global currency into the future, right? So yes, you know, there's no argument for me on the Bitcoin is short-term volatile. What I'm saying is, I think things that stabilize prices are ultimately distortions in the natural process of, you know, finding exchange ratios between all the millions of products and services and people making those decisions. And I think given the choice, I'd rather have a deflationary currency than one that just simply preserves its purchasing power.
Well, I think our current fiat regime is very distortionary when there are huge injections of money specifically into financial markets.
Absolutely.
But that wasn't the nature of the classical gold standard. There, the money is diffusing out of gold mines through economic exchanges, purchases by the gold mine owners and such. It's not in any really noticeable way distorting relative prices or financial markets.
But how then is it stabilizing purchasing power?
Well, the supply of growing.
Right. So all I'm saying is, you know, again, given the choice of a deflationary currency versus one that just maintains its purchasing power, so not inflationary or deflationary, I certainly know which one I would choose.
No, I think that's right. Other things equal, including volatility, then people would choose the appreciating currency. I think that's right. Mm-hmm.
I wonder, guys.
That's actually a very standard argument in the theory of monetary policy.
Sure.
Milton Friedman made this argument back in the 60s that it's better to have an appreciating money than one that's flat or losing value from the point of view of the people holding it.
Yes.
I wonder, guys, if, sorry for jumping in, I'm just listening to both sides here. And I'm wondering, like, you know, if there's kind of like a misalignment on time horizons. We're all talking about money of the future. I think we're just programmed naturally to think the future is, you know, the next 5 to 10 years. For me personally, when I think about Bitcoin and I think about the future of money, to use that phrase, and you know, I won't speak on John's behalf, but for me, I see this as generational. This isn't 5 to 10 years for me. This is 100 to 200 years. So I just want to put that out there and see if that might change the conversation a little bit. John, if you wanted to jump in next.
Well, I would just say I agree with you. Now, whatever our individual predictions are on how long it will take for Bitcoin to monetize or to become, you know, the dominant global currency, is it 20, 50, 100, 200 years? Who knows? But to your point, yes, absolutely. I'm not thinking about this as something I'm going to pay my rent with next year or take profits on in 2 years. You know, and in that context, actually, in practice, Bitcoin is not volatile at all for me, because I'm not looking to sell it at, you know, at any point in the foreseeable future. So it is very much a, you know, I'm holding this, what I believe to be better money, as contributing to its monetization over the course of however many years that takes. And at some point in the future, when it has become monetized, when it is accepted as currency, when the technology has developed to make it easier to use in practice, et cetera, then I might consider doing so. But you know, you're absolutely right that that should be stated, that this is, we're not looking at this in terms of a short-term investment to get rich. We're looking at this in the context of the next evolutionary step in the history of money, which is, I know everyone on this call, I'm sure, thinks that's an incredibly rich field of study, and I'd recommend it to anybody. But in that these things often take a long time, these transitions from one dominant form of money to another. And so, yes, I agree with what you said, Dan.
And if I can ask you, what's your feeling about Bitcoin supporters on Twitter who like to jump on every time the price is up 10% and do a victory laugh?
I think I'll let everyone chime in, but I think, this is part of the reason why Bitcoin's been able to be kind of under the radar a bit is because of how it seems on the surface. You know, I've interacted with a lot of Bitcoiners over the years, and, they're often very educated, studied, articulate, thoughtful, etc. But there's definitely a playful, rebellious, or rebellious attitude in the community. And for whatever reason, I think we'll have to wait for the history books to be written to look back on and kind of parse why that might be. But I think it's just people that are excited about the prospect of a form of money that's going to permit a dramatically different, way of living, exchanging, a different type of economy for us as human beings to avail ourselves of. Incredibly excited of that prospect and the implications of it. And on the journey of getting to that kind of endpoint, I think they're having fun and they're watching it closely. And look, that all being said, nobody's gonna, everyone gets a little excited at the prospect of becoming richer, So if you've been on this journey for a long time and you've been a dyed-in-the-wool supporter and you believe this is the future of money and you want to bring this future forward as fast as possible because of all the things that it means. You see the price going from 10,000 to 20,000 or whatever. One, you're getting richer, and that's always nice. And two, it's validation. It's a type of validation, though it waxes and wanes, from the market. And so I think as that continues to happen, people's conviction hardens, more people are brought in, people are financially incentivized and financially free to pursue things that don't, like as Bitcoin's price increases, a lot of people in the community will become more financially free to maybe contribute to Bitcoin or pursue a career or life that's more enjoyable or meaningful to them. And so I think all these things and more are kind of wrapped up in the excitement and the kind of oddness of the quote unquote community in general.
Lawrence, that's a great question, and I think we should all be put on the spot. So, Kayvon, if you're ready to go, go for it. If not, I'll go and give you a bit more breathing space.
Yeah. No, let me just say, because Lawrence, it's a good question. Yeah, why do people? Because I mean, that's the human psychology, right? I mean, we are all of us in the Bitcoin community. We're all experiencing people calling us. People. I mean, I've had no calls from people who I've never had contact with for years now. And why? Not only because the number goes up, but because, everything is unfolding. So it's what is, the number go up meme actually showing? It's actually showing, manifesting, expressing the resilience, that I am right. See, I was right. We are all right in this. And that's why we say, we're not here for the money, but for the money. And and it's of course it's a inspirator. It's a, what do you call it, like a motivator, or it shows us that it works, right? After 11 years of monetary evolution, it's like 11 years. It's nothing. I don't see it in 100 and 200 years. By the way, Daniel, after our talks, with Jeff Booth, the author of Price of Tomorrow, he says that central banks, they're fighting against gravity. So the deflationary, especially the technological deflation and deflationary prices are coming one way or another. We can't fight against these forces. So it's coming anyway. So why not, have already, this is why my question, which John actually articulated much more eloquently than me, is like,
you know, could Bitcoin be the one and only free market money? Because we don't have, because it's permissionless, we don't need to ask anybody for permission. It is born as a black market money for 8 billion people, essentially. I mean, I don't know. Am I wrong on this, or?
I had another question. Well, I was going to say, don't put me on the spot defending other gold bugs.
Okay. Well, I'll finish off the Bitcoin podcaster's defense on Bitcoin and your question. You know, what do we think of people that you know, start shouting and screaming and making a noise on Twitter when Bitcoin rises 10%? Lawrence, my background was in foreign exchange. I was a foreign exchange broker for 18 years. And so I've been exposed to markets and volatility and seen people, you know, elated and broke in a day. So when I see this kind of behavior on Twitter, I can sniff the traders. I can see who the traders are, and they're just to be ignored. They are completely and utterly, they're not grasping what's occurring. They will, because this will be their first step into this space, but they're not yet. And then on the other side of the virtual coin are the people that are making the noise in a kind of mimetic way, in a comedic way, of those people. Now, to the outsider looking in, it just looks like a bunch of noise, like a bunch of guys at a party. So until you understand like the nuance of both sides of what's going on, then it's actually a pretty quiet place when you're in the middle, and as a hodler, if you will. It is a pretty quiet place, because Bitcoin is a pretty, yes, the volatility and the sticker price is crazy, but the technology and the protocol like is boring as all hell.
Just and, keeps working.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's my response, but it is a great question. Thank you.
Well, as a follow-up, let me ask you this. Do you see the adoption of Bitcoin continuing to grow at the desired rate? Hasn't it cooled off a bit?
Huh, good question. First thing I would say, I don't think there is a desired rate. I think Bitcoin's going to do what Bitcoin is going to do. It's there for people to decide, and people will come to it when they're ready. What I think has been incredible over the first 11 years of Bitcoin is that people on the street have had a chance to get into a financial asset before, well, for you know, on the surface of what we think, what we believe, not what we definitely know, but before governments, before hedge funds, before huge financial institutions, before sovereign wealth funds, before huge pension funds, before banks. This so far has been a very, very, very slow adoption. And I think Keyvan was, you know, saying earlier, Paul Tudor Jones today is now making a lot of noise, and, Raoul Powell and Dan Tapiero, huge, Dan Moorhead as well, huge, huge funds now are coming in. And what is that going to do to the price? What is that going to do to adoption?
Hello?
We're still here?
Yeah. I'm still here.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. yeah. Okay. So that was my response. Sorry, guys.
Keyvan, do you want to?
No, I see the critical adoption rate. I mean, I just observe. I mean, I have people around me who are now total Bitcoiners, you know, and I see, you know, more and more as things unfold, you know, with the economy crashing or whatever, you know, there's like really a disaster going on right now, small or mid-sized companies or businesses. So I think there is a process of adoption on different levels. Merchants, you know, shop owners, businesses, you know, the average pensioner, you know, who just maybe wants to, save a little bit, or it's a saving technology, right? I mean, it's a saving technology. And I think it will happen maybe even simultaneously, maybe even as it will transition slowly or maybe gradually and then suddenly into a medium of exchange. But I see that much, much sooner than we could even anticipate. But that's my, my perspective.
Sorry, Lawrence, go ahead.
I was just going to say it won't take double-digit inflation to drive more adoption of Bitcoin and of gold as investments if we get negative interest rates in a big way. I think that will interest a lot of people in alternatives to holding fiat money.
I agree with you. And I think despite my feelings that gold was the best form of money until Bitcoin and now Bitcoin is, I still think, to put it somewhat playfully, that gold's got a few pumps left in it, because I think it's so ingrained into the world. It's been around for 5,000 years, and there's a lot of people that still read newspapers despite the fact that the internet, the entirety of the world's knowledge is available on your smartphone for you to curate your own news for yourself. Some people are creatures of habit. I don't think that will persist past, more than another generation or two, but that's just my personal feelings. And regarding the pace of adoption, I think, I think it's proceeding apace. As Daniel said, I'm more interested in whether the protocol is still doing what it's meant to be doing, and it's very boring and unexciting, but the answer is yes. And I think the adoption won't be linear, but it, and it changes as you go along. And just as a personal example, when I first bought Bitcoin, I sold it for other things. I thought it was interesting because it was money outside the hands of government. It was permissionless, decentralized, all the things that we've been talking about, but I didn't appreciate it to the extent that I now do. And so before, in an earlier cycle, I may have been one of the ones selling, because I was still maybe earlier in my education and my perspective on this thing, to where the point I am now is I wouldn't think of it. It's not going anywhere, because I feel like I have a greater appreciation for what it represents. So I think people will get drawn in on the hype cycles via, because of greed, because of all the different things that draws people in. And then market conditions may change. A lot of people will be flushed out, and there will remain people that say, I got burned perhaps, but I want to learn. There's something here. I'm sensing something. I want to learn more. And with each successive wave, I think the foundation hardens. And that is, the growing foundation is what I'm concerned with, not the blow off tops in each big hype cycle. So in that context, I'm very happy with where we are after 11 years, and I'm pretty darn excited to see what the next 10 years holds.
Well, maybe we can have this conversation in another 10 years. Take stock.
So Lawrence, should we put you on the spot then? And but I don't think
I guess that's what I'm here for.
yeah. Well, not really. No, that was never the intention. When the three of us, dreamed this up, it's here's a gentleman that, he has a solid argument that we need to hear, because it's easy to get stuck in an echo chamber. And, we are just searching for the truths, for answers. And John has been a gold bug, and as he said, that there's plenty of price movement left in that to the upside. We all know this, and it certainly is not a bad investment.
Let me say one other thing on behalf of gold, which is blockchain technology is coming to gold markets, which is going to make it more transactable than it used to be. I'm sure you've heard that there's now a gold tether, and there's another service called Glint, which is much the same. what concerns me about them right now is that it's not exactly transparent what you're acquiring and what assets the parent company actually has, how transparent they are about being audited and so on. But assuming they could come up with some verifiable way of, taking custody of your gold and allowing you to transfer gold from account balance to account balance with other people who have gold, that could be an alternative transaction mechanism when fiat money becomes more unstable.
Mm-hmm. A big fear over Bitcoin is obviously it getting hacked. When noobs and beginners are looking at it, that's a lot of FUD around it. It's it can be easily stolen, easily hacked, internet money. I don't know, like, gold's been around so long. How many gold jobs have there been in the past? what would make and bank robberies and whatever else, do you think it would make people more comfortable to now suddenly move to a blockchain technology just because it's on gold?
Well, what people are looking for is verification that the vault where your gold is supposed to be actually has your gold. Mm-hmm. Or if it's issuing claims to gold, that it has assets with which it can repay those claims. And information technology makes it possible for you to monitor that from your desktop now, where it used to be you just had to rely on the bank to honestly audit itself, or to be a member of a clearinghouse that honestly audited it.
So it comes back to trust, Lars, right? I mean,
it comes back to mechanisms for verification.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's the big distinction. And as much as free market competition can serve to, keep market actors trustworthy to a point, and there are many examples of this in the past, the problem is that it's still based on trust and verification, and that verification is based on trust. So, and you could make an argument, I'd be receptive to an argument that there are levels of trust that are required for interacting with Bitcoin as well. I just think they are far fewer, and as a result, I think any separation of, using gold person to person is probably I'm most receptive to that argument, but of course, there's many challenges to that as well. But any separation between the individual and the actual money, rather than a claim on the money, invites, third party security holes, invites trust. And I think if history is any judge, push comes to shove, that trust can be damaged, or it can be withdrawn, and then we have problems. And I think that's part of the reason why there's so much enthusiasm for Bitcoin, is because if it doesn't solve that problem, it dramatically improves it.
So the sort of the thrust of my historical work is that banking systems work better than you might expect without deposit insurance and without central banks, and the problems of fraud and wildcat banking were actually very rare. It's kind of a colorful myth that populates some textbooks, mm-hmm. That these were big problems. They weren't, in fact. But I would put it this way, that there is a trade-off between an absolutely trust-minimized exchange system and an inexpensive exchange system. So trust minimization is costly, and sometimes it's cheaper to go with trust than to take every last step to minimize the need for trust. And I think this trade-off was recognized by some of the pioneers of Bitcoin. I've gone back and reread the old writings of Nick Szabo and Hal Finney, and they're quite clear about this, that what Satoshi did was to adopt a security protocol which is quite transactionally expensive, in order to provide greater security. And sometimes we don't, and ordinarily I would say, we don't need that level of security to transact.
Yeah, I don't have much argument with that. I think that's definitely a trade-off that they did make. And I think it's dependent upon how you judge that trade-off is dependent upon what you think is more important or what is lacking in the existing money system. Is it trust that's lacking, or is it, cost-effective, cost-efficient transactions? Now, the answer is both, but I mean, where does your kind of ratio of importance fall? But I would also say on that point, in that I don't think Bitcoin, I think it's focusing on the most important aspect first, and I think that is all the things about Bitcoin that allow it to be trust minimized, as you said. And I think as Bitcoin is evolving, I think we will see efforts and ways and technologies developed to solve higher or, for problems that are less fundamental, for example, speed or cost of transactions later on and on a lower priority level than the foundation of trust. So if we can grant that we've established, digital scarcity or absolute scarcity in the digital realm, and this is something that we can have a tremendous amount of trust in because of its security and other reasons, then we can take that and develop solutions for other issues we might have further down the line, i.e. transacting in a cost-effective manner. And of course, I'm sure everyone on this call is aware of the ongoing efforts and projects in order to do that, the Lightning Network being one of them.
Can I just ask kind of a generational question? We're spanning generations here on this call. Lawrence, what do you think somebody aged between like 15 to 20 right now would invest in over the next 10 to 15 years as they, come of age and earning money and enter the workforce? Are they more likely to buy gold or Bitcoin?
That's a good question. I suppose we could do some kind of marketing survey to find out what current 15 to 20 year olds are buying. I don't know. I can see your point that people who've grown up with Bitcoin in existence are going to be more comfortable with taking it for granted that it's there and it's an alternative and it works.
And I'm 43 right now. So, anybody from my generation, anywhere, age between like 30 and 50, out of my peer group and my family, I don't know that many people that own gold or have ever really considered investing in gold. And that doesn't mean to say that they are now all investing in Bitcoin. They just hold money. It's just money. So if that's my generation that are not holding gold because they just don't think of it's like, how would they do it? First of all, would be the first question. And where would they store it? They don't really understand like the mechanics of it. But, I think like the generation coming behind us, or the two generations coming behind us, it's just going to be so native to them, so intuitive to them that I don't think it crossed their mind. I just don't think.
Well, somebody's holding the gold because there's something like $8 trillion in monetary gold. That's not even counting jewelry in the hands of the public worldwide. So that gold coins, bars, and exchange traded funds. And ETFs are the way to invest in gold nowadays if you want low transaction costs and you don't want to worry about storage. And those, of course, have been remarkably popular. They've really taken off in the last 10 years.
Maybe it's my peer group, but my peer group, very few of them even invest in stocks and shares. I don't know. Kayvan, John, if you want to...
Don't they have pensions? Don't they have tax-deferred savings?
Right, yes. Then that is done on their behalf, of course. So the pension funds will be doing the investing on their behalf. And of course, they will have a certain, they would have diverse portfolio and managed portfolios. And of course, some of that would be in precious metals.
Well, actually, it's hard to get that into your tax deferred savings. It's possible, but it's not usually one of the default options.
John or Kayvine, do you want to?
Yeah, I just wanted to, in the context of gold, I mean, there are some fundamental questions. I mean, we still think about how did for you, you just mentioned that, you know, the market cap of gold has whatever, $8 trillion.
Yeah.
Okay, how did it achieve that? And is it because it was already tied, you know, for more than 100 years to fiat? What about the transparency, the auditability? I mean, I can only rely on information I'm given. You know, when we talk about stock to flow, for example, it's said that, okay, there's whatever 200,000 tons of gold on stock and the flow is that, but I could never ever audit it as I can. Like right now, I could tell you exactly, you know, the number of blocks, what is blocked and the Bitcoin is being mined. So it's just the non-transparency and the lack of auditability that I think starts already with the issue of gold. What do you think, Lawrence?
Well, no, that's a good question. I mean, I'm relying on figures from this outfit called the World Gold Council, which is basically an association of gold dealers and gold producers. So I have to hope that the interests of the gold producers and the gold dealers are not so perfectly aligned that they're in a conspiracy to fool us all about how much gold there is out there. But that's where the numbers come from. And it used to be, of course, illegal in the United States for citizens to own monetary gold. That was illegal from Roosevelt up through Nixon.
Yeah.
And when it became legal, people started buying Krugerrands at first, and then bullion, and now they buy exchange-traded funds. In the rest of the world, of course, they've invested in gold for generations. And in a lot of countries, it's not even counted as an investment because it's in the form of jewelry, which is a separate category for the World Gold Council. But when people buy 22-karat gold jewelry in India and put it in a bank vault, or a safety deposit box and never wear it, I think you have to consider it an investment.
And it's precious and because it has a monetary premium, but you know, I mean,
Because it can be sold back at the price of gold.
Yeah.
Plus a premium. Uh-huh.
But gold could, theoretically, let's say, you know, something comes up, like something evolutionary, like a 0-1 technological innovation, or are they going to space or whatever? I mean, then relative scarcity of gold is gone. There's no scarcity at all then. I mean, the monetary premium could be lost, theoretically. I'm just, you know, daydreaming right now.
But if we discover a solid gold asteroid, that's right.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I agree with that. There are, you know, potential 0-1 innovations that could impact that. But let's just assume that's maybe as far off that we... Well, actually, let's not make any assumptions, but I want to address something else, because I think it has to be said, and this may not be very attractive on just a fundamentals argument on the monetary properties of Bitcoin versus gold, but I think it's impossible to separate interest in Bitcoin with the political implications that it represents. And as far as at least this is my personal perspective from the conversations I've had, and it's probably more more present in the younger generation. But I can tell, you know, people want change. You know, they look out on the world and they see the way the world is and has been running for a long time. And not only do they see inevitable change on the horizon in the form of a rapidly changing technological landscape, and, you know, rationally thinking, whatever solution I choose today, I want it to be able to retrofit it for the emerging technological future that we're going towards. And I think that is part of the reason for preferring a technological solution like Bitcoin than a more, forgive me, but archaic solution like gold. But I think people, people want change. They want change to the way the world works. And, you know, central banks around the world and the governments associated with them hold a tremendous amount of gold. And the institutions that house and secure and sell is all part of, you know, that system. And I think a lot of people are looking at Bitcoin from the perspective that we've discussed already, but also from the perspective of, you know, I don't want to pump their bags. You know, I want a form of money. I want freedom money. I want money for the people. I want money that's going to be fit for purpose for the future. And I want to take it out of the hands of those people that, in my opinion, have so egregiously mismanaged it and abused it for so long. And so I think there is definitely, for a lot of people, a political component to their interest in Bitcoin.
I have to say that from my own point of view, somebody who's been thinking about these issues since before Bitcoin was launched, one of the things I love about the Bitcoin community is their awareness of these kind of issues. Going to Bitcoin conferences, I finally met people who knew what the word fiat meant, other than gold bugs, and who were no longer under the illusion that we need central banks to manage our money for us, which is not universally recognized within people who want to restore gold as money even. So, yeah, I think there's a great deal of education that people have done when they get interested in Bitcoin into the rottenness of the current monetary system, which is all for the better.
Lawrence.
All for the better for people to recognize it.
Lawrence, do you mind if I ask a really loaded question?
Okay.
And it's about education. And you being a professor of economics at George Mason. In the economics that is taught there, is there any part of the syllabus that focuses on the Austrian side of economics, the Austrian school?
Yes, in our department there is. It's unusual among economics departments in that respect. But in our PhD program, there is a field in Austrian economics. And a number of the faculty have interests in the Austrian tradition and work that into whatever course they're teaching. That would include me.
That's great to hear, because that's not normal. Is that correct?
That is not normal. It's unusual.
And why is that, do you think? And can you please change it? do you have any sway with any of the other big schools?
Well, what I can do at the margin is to supervise PhD dissertations and turn out new professors to populate the world with people who are aware of these issues. And so one of the reasons I came to George Mason was to do that, because I was previously at a place without a PhD program. But it, as you were saying, or someone was saying about something else, it's a generational issue. Mm-hmm. Science advances through the dying off of old professors, which is a line I'm stealing from one of the old Austrian economists.
And patents, but we won't go down that rabbit hole.
Lawrence, I'd like to ask you, what is there a trigger, or, you know, what would it take for you to have any degree of confidence that Bitcoin is becoming or is capable of becoming the dominant global currency?
Well, I would want to see the number of accounts growing, and I would like to see evidence of Bitcoin being used to buy goods and services and not just to swap back and forth with fiat monies.
But would the buying goods and services not follow kind of greater adoption if everything we've been talking about in terms of recognizing an upgraded form of money and as a result hoarding it because of the point in the process that we're in, is it fair to want to see that at this stage? Or are you saying you'd have to wait and see, you know, broad adoption as a store of value and then after that use as a currency and medium of exchange?
Well, broad adoption as a store of value would be one thing, but it wouldn't be displacing the existing monies. in their role as media of exchange.
And what if, Lawrence? That's a serious question. What if it evolves relatively simultaneously? That, you know, because of all these things unfolding right now, maybe at a rate of speed we can't even fathom, that, you know, the second, third layer, whatever, Lightning Network, payment technologies, all these, you know, throughput transactions that people are complaining about Bitcoin. What if this is achievable at the same time we get to a number, let's say 300 million, 500 million people adopting Bitcoin? Would that like make you, you know, like confident and trusting?
Well, certainly more confident. I'm not sure what the number is now, but I would like to see retailers saying, wow, the amount of business I do in Bitcoin used to be 0.5% and now it's 5%. Now it's 10%.
Yeah, that's exactly the reason I wrote this ranty article and get out my frustration a couple of days ago. I said, you know, we got to focus on the merchants. I give, for example, my girlfriend has a company, her own company business, and she said she would love to, you know, offer an alternative payment infrastructure on Bitcoin, but she doesn't have the time or the resource or technical skills or the knowledge. And what if we figure this out? How to do this like really smoothly, user friendly, and safe and secure and private, you know, and with a high degree of privacy.
Kevin, if I can just ask you a question to turn a podcaster onto a podcaster, if that was just like a 1, 2, or 3 click process for your girlfriend to put that on her store, her online store, would she then offer her service or product at a discount if accepting Bitcoin?
Yeah, that's what we were talking about, actually. She would offer her customers 5 to 10% discount and say, you know what, download this app and pay with it. And this is what I was so forward-looking about Strike, because I thought, you know, people don't even need to think about Bitcoin. Maybe they are even Bitcoin haters or ignorant of Bitcoin, but you know, they just pay. Whether they pay in fiat or Bitcoin, it doesn't matter, because the merchant decides in what currency, sort of, or you know, whether in fiat or Bitcoin, the transaction is completed. So this is what I'm looking for. You know, this is my big hope.
So that becomes a double-edged sword. Once that technology is built and the merchants can use it and then accept Bitcoin at a discount because they understand the store of value, that's surely going to drive adoption far quicker than we could ever have thought.
Exactly. But isn't that what BitPay is about and other services that will accept Bitcoin on the merchant's behalf and make it all as seamless as accepting Visa or MasterCard?
Well, I don't know much about BitPay, but I'm like, from the infrastructure, it should be like super, like the Bitcoin qualities, right? Decentralized, fully connected to your own node. And all you need is, you know, just the infrastructure and the customer, all what the customer needs is an app. That's it. However, that's connected, you know, to your, you know, to bank account, debit or escrow or whatever.
I think, in light of current circumstances, and I know, you know, the deflation, inflation debate rages on currently with all the central bank, movements right now, right now. But let's assume that, you know, inflation rears its ugly head at some point, and it's fairly aggressive. Just for the sake of argument, I think a lot of people, especially in the Bitcoin space, have the opinion that, okay, I'm gonna hoard my Bitcoin until absolutely necessary. And if and when a time comes where the money in use, let's say the US dollar, has been so egregiously abused that it, if not collapses, you know, is experiencing a high amount of inflation or even collapses, then I'll shift to using my Bitcoin. But until that time, of course, and when I said Gresham's law earlier, I just meant good money pushes out bad, not, Lawrence, I take your point that there's a legal tender or legal price setting component to that. But just right. That people will use, you know, the bad money as long as they're able, and then in preparation for shifting to a better money. And I think that's probably the mindset that a lot of people in the Bitcoin space have right now.
I think it's interesting to look at where at countries that are having very high inflation and see what's happening there. For example, Venezuela. And in Venezuela, there's an interesting competition between people who are resorting to the US dollar and people who are using Bitcoin. And I read a very interesting story about an individual who was selling his services, some kind of consulting services, online and getting paid in Bitcoin and swapping the Bitcoin locally for Bolivars and using the Bolivars to buy his groceries because the store wouldn't accept anything else.
Yeah.
And other people are dollarizing themselves, but both are illegal.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the dollar, just because the dollar has this larger installed base of places you can spend it, that seems to be the first choice in countries that are undergoing instability.
Absolutely. So I think maybe I should have appended to what I was saying, is that if you have the luxury to save, that's a critical point. Because if it's money that has to be used to transact today, then yes, you're going to use the most transactable currency, the one that's accepted in the most places. If you have the luxury to have a certain portion of your wealth in savings, and I'm not sure if I misquoted Gresham's Law just by saying good drives out bad, but bad drives out good. And I think if you have the luxury to save, then you'll spend the bad and hoard the good.
Well, the good begins to drive out bad when people prefer to be paid in the good money and
right.
demand a big premium if you're going to pay them in the lousy money. And that's how spontaneous dollarization occurs in countries with high peso inflation.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps, you know, we might see a process like that happen with Bitcoin and the dollar at some point.
Well, so then it'll be become a race between people adopting Bitcoin and people adopting gold. But right. The gold transaction technology is not up to speed yet, but could become shortly.
Lawrence, do you mind if I ask, and you obviously, of course, you can say that you do mind, but do you personally hold any Bitcoin?
Not currently, no. I gave a talk in which I was paid in Bitcoin.
And you sold it?
I held on to it. I got it. When I got it, it was 6,000. I held it till it went to 10,500, and then I sold it.
Well, there you go.
I did okay on that cycle.
Yeah, not a bad trade.
And I now have to fill in the tax forms to now that I've admitted it publicly.
Way to go, John. Lawrence.
But I discovered firsthand the insult to your dignity that Know Your Customer represents.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And are you considering, you know, diversifying, you know, into Bitcoin again as a store of value for, you know, perhaps a legacy portfolio?
Well, so most of my saving, well, all of my saving really is done through payroll deductions, and Bitcoin's not an option there as far as I know. But in a few years, I'll retire, and so I'll start managing my own savings. And it makes sense to diversify. And so that includes holding a little bit of gold, holding a little bit of Bitcoin, just as a matter of prudence.
Absolutely.
Lawrence, are there any, I know I saw from your website that you do or have advised other cryptocurrency projects either currently or in the past.
Yeah.
Do you still do that? And if so, what is it about other projects that you find worthy of your support or interesting?
Well, they came to me and said they were interested in hiring my consulting services. I said, I'm interested. But
just don't pay me in your coin.
not only in your coin. Yeah. I like that you're confident in your coin, but
yes.
So one of those is not really a crypto. It's called Initiative Q. And it's kind of a Hayekian project where the issuer is going to try to stabilize the purchasing power by changing the quantity as necessary, but very much human hands-on and not algorithmic. And the other one, but I haven't talked to them in about a year, is Beam, which is a privacy coin. And they've been up and down in terms of market cap, but my advice to them was try to find some way to make this more transactable than other coins, and then you can make a pitch to people that there's a good chance that you'll be adopted at someday as a more widespread medium, because if you're just another store of value, it's hard to differentiate yourself.
What do you think, maybe a top three sort of priorities or attributes of a money that make it more transactable in your opinion? Or however many you like, but just I was wondering what the top three might be.
Well, there are the sort of the concrete transaction costs of releasing ownership and directing the ownership to the person who's receiving it. So the archaic technology was handing over a coin. Banking systems came along and made it much more convenient to write checks or initiate giro payments. And today, of course, it can all be done online, deposit transfer. Secondly, is the stability of purchasing power, at least low volatility from day to day, week to week. And then I think third, and this is sort of lurking in the background, is some basis for confidence that the stability of purchasing power will be maintained and we're not just in a lucky phase. And so it's that third thing that I worry about the current day fiat monies, because there's no constitutional rule. There's nothing that limits the Fed's discretion. There's no guarantee that we won't return to double digit inflation.
And in terms of, you know, preserving purchasing power being an important aspect of adopting it for transactions, what is it that gives it its purchasing power in the first place, these potential currencies that we're talking about?
Well, it's supply and demand. So the volatility of purchasing power is going to depend on the volatility of demand and the, you might say, the flatness of the supply curve. So that when there's a change in demand, does the action take place in the purchasing power dimension or does it take place in the quantity dimension? Right? If more money is forthcoming whenever more money, whenever the public wants to hold more of that money, then that'll help preserve stability of the purchasing power. And that's the great virtue of a free banking system, where you have competition among different banks. If people want to hold more of the banknotes issued by Bank X, Bank X will be happy to issue more. And across the banking system, if people want to hold more bank-issued money of whatever brand, the banks will be happy to issue more. And competition will compel them to withdraw it from circulation if the public doesn't want to hold it, because the public has the option to redeem it for some more basic money. Mm-hmm. So you get that kind of stabilizing force. And this was understood at least as far back as Ludwig von Mises' theory of money and credit in 1914. But underlying the banking system is the basic money, and the attractive feature of a gold standard is that in the long run, the supply curve is pretty flat. You can get more gold without much of an increase in its purchasing power. More so in the long run and in the short run, but definitely over 10 to 20 years.
What would you say is the relationship or the importance of the cost to produce a money to its market value?
Well, in equilibrium, price equals cost of production. But from an Austrian perspective, it's the willingness of the public to pay that determines the purchasing power, and the cost will adjust to that. Mm-hmm. So in a gold standard, the amount of gold mining that goes on will depend on the purchasing power of gold as determined by the interaction of supply and demand.
Right. And so you know, if it's, so then we have to think, if it's dependent upon the willingness of the public to pay, then it, we do have to consider what influences that willingness on behalf of the individual or the public to value or demand a given currency. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but potentially one of the reasons why gold was successful as money is because part of an individual's demand for it was because they knew that because of its scarcity, and they knew that it wasn't easily, more of it wasn't easily created, you know, it, at great cost was more created, and that contributed to their demand for it.
Yeah, and they didn't have to, people didn't have to be aware of that in any very explicit way, but they knew that during their lifetime, the purchasing power hadn't changed much.
Sure, sure.
Really basic question. When we're talking about the purchasing power of gold, are we talking about purchasing fiat?
No, I'm talking about in terms of goods and services. How many ounces of gold it takes to buy a standard basket of goods and services, like the CPI bundle.
Right, okay. But to make that purchase, you would have to go via fiat to do that.
Oh, today, now that gold is demonetized, but back under a gold standard, you could hand over physical gold or claims to vaulted gold.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I just wanted to clear that up. Thank you. Actually, Lawrence, before we wind this up, I wanted to ask you about, just because it's a very topical question, that I was talking with another podcast guest earlier who has made an amazing piece of artwork of Plan B's stock to flow graph. And in that piece of artwork, it was very controversial on Twitter. She shredded $4 bills, actually 10 in total for the artwork, but filmed herself shredding $4 bills. And that caused a huge stir, as you can imagine, on Twitter. Now,
if she ate a $10 burrito, would that upset people?
Right, exactly. That was her point. Like, you know, it's my money. I can do what I like with it. But apparently, you know, not.
Well, everybody else should thank her, because by making dollars more scarce, she's increasing their purchasing power.
Yes. She shreds 10 bucks whilst $6.5 trillion is getting printed. You know, it's a drop in the ocean.
True. But
I've noticed recently on Twitter, you've been talking about using currency iconography, you know, to measure institutional quality, and currency notes issued by state authorities, and I'm reading directly here, commonly depict symbols of power. Could you talk to a little bit about that, and, you know, the kind of, you know, just to put a little bit more, rub a little bit more stank on it, the kind of the kind of brainwashing that we've endured as societies over the last God knows however many years with this kind of subliminal messaging on our fiat banknotes.
Right. So initially, banknotes were not a creation of the state. They were invented by private commercial banks, and they weren't actually very decorated in the early days, but as banks were competing and trying to make their notes more attractive, they started putting attractive images on them, but they had no interest in propagandizing on behalf of the government. So they had pictures of people plowing, and railroads in the United States was a common theme. And there are still private banknotes that I referred to in this tweet, in Scotland, Northern Ireland, Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, it's mostly dragons on the banknotes. And in Macau, I don't really know what the currency in Macau looks like. But in Northern Ireland and in Scotland, they have the famous poets, Robert Burns. They have scientists, Lord Kelvin, and other cultural heroes. They don't put dead politicians on their banknotes, and they don't glorify the state. They're trying to create a kind of positive, cheerful, optimistic image. But when the state took over and the issue of banknotes, then we got, actually it's a repetition of what we got when the state took over coinage, which was they began to put their own pictures, pictures of statesmen and generals on the face of the currency as a way of making it, I don't know, more somber or more serious, or at least in the United States, there's a rule that you don't put anybody living on the currency. So it's sort of the long run glorification of the state rather than of any living politician. But in, you know, countries with one party rule, it's often the current leadership who are depicted on the banknotes. And so very much the way Caesar used it, it's very much propaganda on behalf of the glory of the current government.
Yeah, another fly in the ointment of fiat currency. Well, guys, how do you feel? Lawrence, we should give the floor to you in case, you know, I don't want you to feel as though you've been ganged up on here and, you know, kind of dragged across the coals. So if
no,
you
not have, at all.
Great. That's that was never, ever the intention.
I really enjoyed our talk, Lawrence. Do you want to direct your our listeners to any pages, like besides your Twitter handle?
Yeah, so my Twitter handle is LawrenceHWhite1. I have a page at altm.org, which is the blog of the Cato Institute. There it is. The Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives. I haven't been blogging there as much as I used to. Usually it's once a month, and I need to pick up the pace to get back to that. But there's been a lot of distractions in recent weeks.
Yeah, watching the price of Bitcoin.
But anybody who wants to see endless lectures of mine, just Google my name, Lawrence H. White, and there are plenty.
Well, Lawrence, I just want to thank you for taking the time to have this chat today. I'm glad our Twitter back and forth manifested in this. And I'll just further say, look forward to our discussion in 10 years' time.
Maybe. Okay, best wishes.
Take care, Lawrence.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank bye-bye.
Have a good evening. So what do you guys think about this discussion with Lawrence H. White in this special Bitcoin Podcasts Roundtable edition together with John Vallis and Daniel Prince, both some of my favorite Bitcoin podcasters? It's really important to question, you know, where are we going? Why are we doing this? Why Bitcoin? What are the root causes? What's our wish, our desire to create? To evolve into. And sometimes I think maybe it's really good that Bitcoin is not really deeply in its totality comprehended, understood by people. Maybe Bitcoin needs to do its own thing. Maybe there's a reason why Bitcoin is still, you know, underestimated, not understood, or, you know, the power is not really felt. So with all the pain points that are now, you know, more and more coming to the surface because of this, you know, rotten, sick, destructive, kleptocratic monetary economical system, talking about, you know, pun intended, central banks, nation states, governments, and, you know, the whole centralized entities and structures, and causing inflation, hyperinflation, theft on a, you know, on a scale which we probably can't even calculate. You know, the constant printing of trillions and trillions and trillions of fiat money, the constant debt credit expansion, the destruction of economies, the destruction of of existence, of livelihoods. So this is why, you know, I see an unexpected evolution of Bitcoin, not only as a store of value, but as a medium of exchange. And it will happen, I think, much faster than we could even imagine, because, you know, this is why it's my top priority for myself, is to educate also as many merchants, businesses, shop owners, people, you know, who have businesses, to adopt these technologies, these platforms. And I know, yeah, we gotta still work on the user friendliness, on the simplicity of it, of, you know, of taking away the fear and empowering the people around us, whether it's the average customer, user, merchant, shop owner. And with all the conditions now unfolding, credit expansion, you know, inflation, the printing of trillions and trillions and trillions of fiat, there is, you know, it's inevitable. So that's the question, you know, what unique monetary properties does Bitcoin have? And it is unique. Bitcoin is, that's why Bitcoin is so unique compared to gold, because you got to ask yourself whether you're, you know, you own or possess gold, how are you going to validate it? How are you going to audit it? How can you rely on some numbers that are given to you? How are you going to transport it, especially electronically? Can it, you know, how are you going to trade with it? How are you going to validate, assay the authenticity? What about decentralization? What about the danger and threat of confiscation, which we had, you know, in 1933 with Roosevelt? And anyway, so let us know your questions, your comments. Why do you think? What do you think? What do you think is going to happen? What do you think needs to happen? How can we, you know, accelerate the empowerment, the monetary evolution of Bitcoin, so more and more people start at least, you know, just hodling a fraction of Bitcoin? How can we inspire and educate and empower more and more merchants, businesses, shop owners, to embrace this technology and this the applications for Bitcoin, and start, you know, doing transactions with the customers by giving them, you know, a discount, for example, which a lot of people would do. So people are ready. I'm seeing it. I'm feeling it. I can observe it. A lot of Bitcoiners can testify to that, that there are more and more people waking up. They're questioning a lot of things now, even gold holders. They're asking me, you know, starting to ask, you know, what is going to happen to gold? What if we truly find, I mean, that could happen because technology is so exponential by order of magnitude, and not only deflationary, you know, you will pay, you know, you're paying less and less and less for better and, you know, more advanced and 0-to-1 technologies, which will happen now in the next years and decades to come. Beyond our imagination. So let us know your questions, your comments, your feedback, or whether you would like to have any special guest next on our podcast's roundtable, panel discussions. And yeah, thanks so much for support and for listening. Make sure you follow us on Twitter. It's all in the show notes. And yeah, thanks so much for listening and for your support, and let us know your feedback and your questions.